Please support the Climate Change and Happiness podcast. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.
Welcome to Climate Change and Happiness, an international podcast that explores the personal side of climate change, your feelings, what the crisis means to you, and how to cope and thrive. And now, your hosts, Thomas Doherty and Panu Pikkala.
Well, hello, I'm Thomas Doherty.
And I am Panu Pikkala.
And welcome to Climate Change and Happiness. This is our podcast, the show for people around the globe who are thinking and feeling deeply about climate change and other environmental issues. And we pose this provocative question, you know, what does it mean to be happy in the modern world? And Panu's an emotions researcher, and I'm a psychologist, and Panu's in Finland, and I'm in Portland, Oregon. Panu's evening, my morning. We're really happy for a few things. I'm going to introduce a special guest here in a moment. We've also been looking at some of our podcast stats for 2024. And, you know, listeners, we have listeners in 35 countries all around the world. We have thousands of listeners. We're not a huge podcast. Obviously, it's kind of a specialized niche that we fill. But we do have thousands of listeners. And so, listeners, I want you to know you're not alone. There's people coming from all around the world. Some of the countries you might imagine, like the US and Canada and UK, but also Bulgaria and Saudi Arabia and New Zealand and Indonesia. And so we have a lot of folks that are listening. And today we have a special guest.
And I think I'm going to introduce myself, Gregory Hill. I'm an academic of all kinds of different subjects and hopefully still a good eco friend.
Yeah, and Greg is here in Portland, and he is a friend of mine, a long-standing friend of mine. And our episode kind of theme today is this idea of eco friends. It's a concept I kind of coined in this book manuscript I'm working on. It's not a complicated idea. It's just the idea that we have friends in the world that inspire us and help us to develop our own environmental identity and our own environmental values, and we share our work and goals with them. Sometimes we work directly with them. Sometimes we just hear what they're doing. Sometimes they're in a far afield career from what we're doing. But I think everyone around the world can either think about eco friends that they have, could be personal friends or family, or could be work colleagues. It could be distant. Panu and I would consider us to be eco friends. We don't meet in person, but we know each other through the distance. Some friends are longstanding life friends and some are new, but that's the concept for today. Just to get into. So listeners, I want you to be thinking about eco friends that you might have and, or you can cultivate or find. And then Greg is a very interesting eco friend. He's done a lot of things. He's originally from Arizona in the U.S., and he's spent time growing up around the Grand Canyon and exploring in the Grand Canyon, and he's done work. He kind of exemplifies a lot of the trend of environmental action over the last, you know, few decades. You know, he's earlier when he was younger, he worked in anti-nuclear weapons advocacy. He has worked around the world and Indonesia and like a forest reclaiming, you know, tropical wood. And he has been a mathematician and an environmental studies professor and a baseball player and a chess player. And now recently does research on salmon in the Northwest and the dams, and works with First Nations people in Canada to assert their rights and autonomy. So really interesting possibilities. And Panu, I know you have eco friends as well, and I'm sure in Finland that's an idea that would go over well. Panu, do you want to get us started today?
Pleased to meet you, Greg. So we have a quite different dynamic here between the three of us. I know that you two have indeed known each other for a long time, but when Greg, you think about the roots of this vocation you've had and strong interest and motivation to work with the natural world or the modern human world. So what comes to your mind? What would you like to share about the sort of roots and foundations and perhaps early life history in relation to that?
Well, the roots are certainly my mother.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents moved to Arizona from Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother really took to the desert, to the Sonoran Desert that I grew up in southern Arizona. And over my right shoulder here, I don't know if anybody can see this, there's a backpack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my mother's backpack. And she and I would go backpacking together. Before backpacking, we were exploring the desert together, like when I was in single digits age.
Mm-hmm.
So she really taught me to appreciate nature, but also while appreciating the social life, our social relationships. And that has percolated all the way through my entire career, where I study systems. And I study social ecological systems in particular.
Mm.
I could talk just about my mother the entire time.
yeah, and that's a good sign of a person. I think, and I can actually see the backpack, dear listeners. Too bad, listeners, that you can't see it.
Yeah.
See the visuals, but that's still looks like in good condition with various. Or marks, possibly from...
It's got a lot of badges on it, some of which were because of directions that I made my parents drive when we went to California. We would drive to California, and I would make them stop certain places, like along the Pacific Crest Trail,
mm-hmm.
which is a trail that goes from all the way from Mexico to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Up the west side of the United States, yeah. And I would make them get badges, and some of those badges are right there. Mm. They've been there a long time.
Oh, yeah, that's wonderful. And you have this strong interest and learning in systems approaches now, but was there earlier phases in your engagement with the natural world, or... Was there something that first motivated you, which led then to developing a more systems-like approach, or how did that work for you?
Well, the systems approach definitely took a lot longer to develop. My first kind of explorations, Thomas was referring to some of them, like my exploration of the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon. I was a member of a backpacking organization. I was with a friend. We were the youngest ones.
Mm.
We were, I think, 14 when we joined.
Mm.
And it was a little controversial to have kids that young, right? Couldn't drive, for instance.
Mm.
But, you know, so we got rides with people all the way up to the Grand Canyon. And I had some really incredible experiences up there as a youngster, both social and ecological.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would help people because there were some older people on these trips, and going down into Grand Canyon can be pretty rugged.
Mm-hmm.
And I would help them. One woman who is my friend's mother came with us, and she was really struggling, and I carried her backpack as well as my backpack out of the river,
mm-hmm.
out of the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like combining that social engagement with nature is old for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think of it in a systems kind of way then,
mm-hmm.
but it certainly came naturally to me later.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, and it also links with this theme that Thomas spoke about, eco-friends or... friends who share environmental values or identity with you, or friends who share at least some parts of our journeys in mm-hmm. relation to the modern human world. And there's often mentoring figures we earlier at an episode talked with Luis Chavla, who has done research on various things that affect people's relationship with the natural world. Usually when they are young, and it's quite common to have at least some close person, perhaps a grandparent, if not parents, or an uncle or aunt, or local Boy Scouts leader or Girl Scouts leader, who becomes quite formational in leading us into a deeper engagement with what surrounds us. So in my mind, that team sort of mentoring and broadly speaking educating also links with this topic of eco-friendship. But what about you too? You say that you are eco-friend, so how does that manifest in practice? What does it mean to be an eco-friend?
Yeah, I can share a little bit about, I mean, we have, like a lot of friends, we have slightly different stories about our pasts and how we met. Just like siblings, we'll have different memories. But I'm just thinking about Greg and the Grand Canyon. I mean, I think if someone, for listeners who haven't been to the Grand Canyon, it's very deep. So it's sort of it reminds me of, I've met people that grew up near the Alps, for example, or near other mountains, and they from a young age learn to climb up the mountains and perhaps help guide other people up the mountains. But in the Grand Canyon, it's easy to get to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. You essentially just keep walking and rolling down to the bottom, but getting out is sort of like climbing a mountain to get out. So I think that what Greg is saying, carrying that pack out, it's sort of like carrying someone's pack up the Matterhorn or something like that.
Well, that same group that I went to Grand Canyon with, we also climbed a lot of mountains.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that, for instance, is the same between me living here in Portland, Oregon, very different climate from Arizona, but same mountains.
Yeah.
I mean, not the same mountain range, right? But the same structure of the mountains. And so I feel at home, even though it's raining all the time here right now, you know,
and
it's not in Arizona, let me tell you.
Yeah. So, that's that systems perspective. We can see similarities around the world in different ecosystems. But, you know, how Greg and I met, at least my recollection of it, this would be coming on 25 years ago, 23 years ago, I think. We met actually at a Zen meditation retreat at a place called the Great Bao Zen Center here in Western Oregon, which is a traditional Zen monastery, American Zen monastery. And we actually met at a unique event. It was a deep ecology retreat at the Zen Center. And one of the speakers there was Michael Soleil, who's a conservation biologist, who is one of the founders of conservation biology. And so it was this fruitful mashup of conservation and environmental consciousness and Buddhism, in this case Zen Buddhism. And I think, Greg, that is one of the strong strands in your life that, you know, if not not introduced you to systems thinking, at least it kind of exemplifies systems thinking.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. So I mean, Zen Buddhism is something that I first encountered when I was 16. Mm. And I was a fan of the Beat Generation. Mm. And I somehow managed to get permission from my mother to drive all the way from Tucson to San Francisco. Mm. I didn't drive. I had a friend who could drive and had a car. And we drove actually nonstop from Tucson, Arizona to San Francisco, not just any place in San Francisco, to the City Lights bookstore. Mm-hmm. Either of you know City Lights bookstore?
I do, yeah.
So it was kind of home base for the Beat Generation and all those books,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I went there. But one of the people I read when I was reading about the Beat Generation was this guy, Gary Snyder, who was a poet. Mm. And not just a poet, but I really admired his poetry. And he was also a Zen guy. And so through reading him when I was young, I learned about the San Francisco Zen Center when it was just starting up. Mm. And so I broke off from my little group of three people when we were visiting there, and walked across town, downtown, to the San Francisco Zen Center, and mm-hmm. poked my head in, and somebody greeted me, mm-hmm. and I felt welcomed, and I'm, for instance, I'm going back for a month-long retreat in 3 months.
Mm. Yeah.
So I've been with San Francisco Zen Center for a long time. My favorite part of the San Francisco Zen Center is their farm, which is called Green Gulch Farm, and it's also a retreat center, and it's, you know, one of those beautiful places that combines, I'm going to say it again, social and ecological engagement, and how they're connected with each other. Mm-hmm. So that's the system is between social and ecological, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's lovely and interesting to hear also. And I have background in studying religion and environment, so Buddhism comes from there also. And there's a book which might interest also some listeners by Roderick Nash, an environmental historian, called Rights of Nature: History of Environmental Ethics, which is quite interesting, and also devotes several pages on Gary Snyder and strong interest on Zen Buddhism in North America among environmentally minded people. But it's also related to present day activities. One of my dissertation students, who is also a younger colleague, is a practicing Buddhist in Finland, but he's been doing extended interviews of Western engaged Buddhists in climate action. So that paper came out something like a month ago, and it's quite interesting what the Buddhists have been able to give to the climate movement. There's some special features. So just some thoughts reflecting on what you say, and I also see the connection between Buddhism and the systems approach and the social and ecological.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would just add, you know, one of our favorite themes here is environmental identity and our sense of self in relation to nature and the natural world. And I often say that art and literature is part of our environmental identity. And it, you know, Greg's example is a great, and I know this is not unique to Greg or to Panu or to me. Many people are obviously influenced by Buddhism around the world, but also the Beat Generation and the poets and writers there, and that lifestyle or that vision that they evoked, you know, in the U.S. in the 1950s and 60s. And we don't necessarily think of it as an environmental identity at the time when we're younger. We're just finding the world and absorbing everything, but it does become part of our environmental ethos and leads us to value things and then take action. Right. And so I think it's a fair statement, Greg, to say you've been an activist at times in your life based on your social ecological values.
Oh, yeah. 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 Like one thing that combines these is so the 60th anniversaries are a big deal in Japan. It's a time when you become an elder. And in Japan, that's a good thing. And so the 60th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, my Zen community gathered together and went to Japan for the whole group for 2 weeks, me 5 weeks. So I traveled on my own for quite a while, and we had all sorts of engagements with anti-nuclear weapons work, with the social engagement around Buddhism, and particular Buddhist teachers, Dogen, I think of in particular, and then my traveling around Japan was by on my own. Was an incredible lesson in social engagement with others when we don't share a language. Mm. Like, I'll just say one, this may seem like a silly example, but when I was traveling around and on the trains, and especially, I went all the way down south, like all the way south. And so there's trains everywhere and they really run on time. Mm. And the tickets tell you how to get to the next station. in Japanese. And so I couldn't read Japanese at all. I could speak a little bit, but I couldn't read it at all. And so I would just get off the train, I would hold up my ticket in front of me, and inevitably, a Japanese person would see my ticket, grab me by the hand, and walk me to the place I had to go. Mm-hmm. Even if it was like just 2 minutes away was when the when it started. Mm-hmm. So that kind of kindness, and I was doing all this traveling that was really like I climbed mountains and things. So it was really connecting all those things about socialization and how they're connected to the environment.
Yeah.
It was very powerful to me. And I brought it back to Portland, Oregon. I had a meeting. I got a meeting with the minister, not a minister of something that we have in the United States, but a minister of peace, a cabinet level position in Japan. And I got a friend of mine who was bilingual, Japanese and English, and incredibly tall. He was 6'11". He took me to visit this. He arranged the meeting. Mm. And so we went to that minister, and I made my case, and he translated. And at the end, this guy, this minister, revealed that he had really good English. And he said to me, "We have to do this." Mm. So I brought all these artifacts from the bombings to Oregon to exhibit, and I brought four Japanese men to herd around. It was really fun, and the exhibit was on for 2 months.
Mm.
Yeah. So the Zen thing is also all mixed in with social environmental stuff for me. It's a trifecta.
Yeah, yeah. So you can see why I like Greg. He's just no lack of interesting stories, and he's, you know, really is a world citizen, and it's inspiring. Where should we go in our conversation? Greg, do you want to, you know, in terms of our environmental identity and our eco timeline, it's continues our whole life, and we're always extending that timeline. And the, I think, what is the Japanese, the name for the 60th birthday, Hemerek, what is the name of that?
I can't remember. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. If there's any Japanese listeners out there, you can remind us. But there's a special name for that. And you wear a special hat, you know, for your 60th birthday.
Well, when you came to my 60th birthday party.
I did, yeah. Had a great gathering of all of, that was, talk about eco-friends. That was an incredible gathering of eco-friends.
Everybody around that table were eco-friends, yeah.
And it's one of those things also with, like, I know when I have an old friend and they meet another of my old friends, then it's often fairly quick that everyone connects. So we don't even realize that we have a larger friend connection than we know, because all of our eco-friends have eco-friends. And we're often all on the same page. And at your party, you played a game and had truth or dare stories about your past, which was fun, I remember, which we could, well, we won't go into now. But going forward, you know, what are some ways that you're extending your timeline? And that's a huge question too, obviously, but what comes up for you, you know, and maybe the First Nations work that you're doing in Canada or the salmon work, what's...
Well, I've very recently been liberated. A lot of people call it retirement.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's like I don't have to grade papers anymore.
Okay. Yeah.
And I am completely in charge of my daily routine, completely, which took me a while to understand. And yeah. I'm still kind of, I didn't retire very long ago, just a year ago. So I'm still learning how to do things, but I'm using this freedom I have now to do a lot of things that I wasn't able to do when I was pinned down by other people's schedules. And so, for instance, one thing is I'm arranging, helping with a lot of partners to arrange. You mentioned the work I did with Indigenous people in Canada, and the main person there was this man named Satsan.
Mm-hmm.
And he, for instance, changed the constitution of the country. through a legal process that took many years. And this was that was all before I met him. I met him after that, and when, you know, it's one thing to have the right to of self-determination, which is what he got the legal part down, where First Nations were had the inherent right to self-governance. Before that, not even close to any right like that, right? So he won that right, but exerting that right is another thing. And that's where I worked with him. And the system stuff came in really well. Because Satsan, somehow, when he was sent to residential school, taken away from his family, he somehow got a book that was about systems thinking, like with all the diagrams and stuff. And so he and I really connected on that level. And we became really close partners and dear friends, actually, throughout many years. And now I'm trying to arrange for him a trip to the United States where we're going to have, because now the rule with him, since he's kind of famous now, is that he does only things that have national visibility, that make news like across Canada. And so I'm trying to do one that's based in the United States that still has that across Canada impact. And so I'm working on that. That's just one of the things I'm working on these days.
Wow. That's great. I mean, so you're really leveraging a lot now to make change that's going to affect history and people for generations to come.
Satsan's the history maker. I'm the assistant to the history maker.
Panu, what's coming up for you as you're listening and observing this eco-friend banter that we're having?
Well, it's fascinating how many things, Greg, you have been in touch with, and I hear a strong commitment to justice issues also. And some people nowadays use framings like climate justice or injustice, and of course environmental justice. And I think that's an integral part of having a socio-ecological view on things or systems view. And environmental organizations and institutions are luckily picking that up if they haven't done it before. And for example, in Finland, the climate change expert panel, which is a national thing, already many years ago, did work on the sort of social acceptability and justice dimensions of climate issues. So that's one part of trying to advance things on a practical level.
What's the most exciting part of this for you, Greg? Like, as you have this freedom, we're moving on from your teaching, and we won't get into that, but you, of course, influenced a lot of students and people over the years. Where, you know, what's the equivalent of the climbing the mountain or some challenge or task that you look forward to do here coming up?
So I've had a really long and deep connection to Indonesia and to Southeast Asia in general. A lot of it through a dear friend of mine who's here and who now lives in Portland. Name's Tim O'Brien. And so we have been back and forth between the United States and Indonesia for a long time. And part of that is connected to the environment and social stuff and ethics. And one outcome of that, it's only fairly recently found its full realization, is a carbon offset project, forest-based carbon offset project that I've been told is the largest forest-based carbon offset project in the world. It's in Kalimantan, and it's the work of, two Indonesians, Rezal Kusumatmaja and Darsono Hartono. But Tim and I were definitely part of the team. And that has only recently really seen its full realization as a carbon offset project with all of the numbers, and it was protecting a peat forest, which is like probably the densest carbon offset kind of per acre in the world is in peat forests. And there was a peat forest that was in danger of being destroyed, essentially, for its wood value. And we managed to protect that.
Mm.
And so that it's done in a way, it's really happening. And I was excited at it. You know, I just, one of the people who was involved with that just, you know, was in Portland recently, and we had a good conversation about it, and he's doing more. He's following up in Indonesia with solar stuff in Java.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's my whole time there is really exciting, and I want to go back, and Tim and I have, of course, plans to go back.
Yeah. 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 So this is great, this web of friendship, and I think it's a good place to wrap up our conversation today. Of course, we could go on and on, but it's that web, and you keep following the web, and it leads to more and more things. And realizing that saving a forest these days isn't just about the forest; it's about the entire global ecosystem. And that's one of the new insights of climate consciousness. It's not just the beauty of a particular place, although that's obviously important. An integrity of an individual place, it has ramifications for the whole global system, and it comes back to the human and ecological systems, as you were saying, Greg. You know, we have to work together, and then we have to have that big picture thought. So this has been great. I've been looking forward to having you on the podcast, Greg, and so it's a nice record of our relationship and sharing it with Panu, and maybe Panu, we can have you bring an eco friend next year as well. That would be nice. So let's wrap it up, listeners. I hope you got something out of this, and your homework, if you like, is to think about and connect with your eco friends and recognize that you are eco friends, and just name that, because I think people will appreciate that. But otherwise, listeners, take care. And Greg and Panu, I'll let you have the last word.
Well, I'm down with this eco friends. Why don't we? Can we make it social eco friends?
Sure. Yeah. I'll see you around the campfire soon. And Panu, what's your where are you headed today?
Yeah, it's been a pleasure getting to know a bit about you, Greg. It's like just a glimpse through the clouds to a large terrain. There's evidently lots of that, but feeling grateful for that in the dark Finnish evening. It's the darkest time of the year, but solstice is soon about to come, so there's gonna be more light.
Yes. Anyway, listeners and everyone, listen, find us at climatechangeandhappiness.com. And I appreciate our listeners all around the world. And everyone, be well. The Climate Change and Happiness podcast is a self-funded volunteer effort. Please support us so we can keep bringing you messages of coping and thriving. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.